Like so many moments in history, it was a long buildup, but when it happened really fast. There had been a couple of people who had been unwilling to give up their seat to a white person on the bus in Montgomery County, but the local NCAA officials didn't feel that they were the right people to be their cause to take forward. Their vision was to find the right person who was at the right class, the right level of educated, not too elevated and not too low. And they would appeal her conviction, and it would be the beginning of the end of the segregated buses in Montgomery County. And then one day, Rosa Parks, maybe in her mind she thought it was the time, but Rosa Parks made the decision to not rise and move and stand when she was instructed to do so by the bus driver. Local clergy and National Association of Colored People, NAACP folks, let me get my acronyms right, coalesced around her and quickly figured out a plan for how they were going to elevate her case in the legal system. But a group of women who had been leaders and were part of a local Negro college got the idea of asking all of the Negro folks in the community to boycott the bus lines. And they printed flyers surreptitiously at their college and spread them out all over town so that by the next morning, many, many people knew, thousands knew, and the buses rolled by vacant. Now, Martin Luther King entered the picture a little later on in that day. He had been out of town and didn't find out about what was happening until he got back and was invited to a group of clergy leaders who were going to figure out what the next steps were and how to take action. He came in late to their meeting, and they'd been kind of batting about how they were going to move forward and who was going to take charge. You've been in meetings like that. No, you. No, really, Joe, I mean you. No, Charlie, it's for you. Political tensions, rivalries between the two made it complicated. And in walked in that 26-year-old brand new preacher at Dexter Baptist. How about you, Martin? And as you heard in that reading, without the thought that was typical of him and the preparation that was typical of him, he said yes. And hours later, he found himself in front of a group of people, 2,000, 5,000, it depends on who you talk to, a group of his community waiting to hear the words that they needed to hear. But let me take a little step back and tell you more about Martin Luther King up until that moment. For a person of his race at that time in the 20th century, he had a very privileged childhood. Both of his parents were college educated. His mother was the daughter of the president of one of the black universities in the community. And he led a very educated, privileged life. The bus boycott wouldn't have meant anything to his family because they all had cars. They all drove wherever they wanted to go. Martin had his life planned out very, very carefully, where he would go to college, where he would go to seminary. He loved to dress up really well, and his friends called him Tweedy because of the tweed jackets that he loved to wear. He and his friends would practice writing their names with all sorts of made-up, you know, PhD, RMP, DRL, whatever they made up to make them, to plan for the days when they would have all these initials past their names. His father had big expectations for him. Expectations were that he would finish at Morehouse, a bachelor's degree at Morehouse, and then come and be the second minister at Ebenezer Baptist in Atlanta, where his father was the senior minister. But Martin had different ideas for his life and different ideas for his theology. He considered himself to be a liberal Christian, and he didn't follow his father's path of the preaching of sin and redemption. He chose what he considered to be a more elevated path. And so despite his father's plans, he attended Crozer Seminary, a liberal white Christian seminary that was short on funds, and admitted 30% of their class when Martin entered were African American. A lot of international people came to Crozer at that time and created this amazingly diverse liberal community, a moment that never happened again at that liberal white institution. Martin subscribed to the ideas of the social gospel. This was a positive theology that held human nature in high esteem. The social gospel preached that love and reason could bring out in people a basic goodness. And this basic goodness was deeper than the racial hatreds or animosity that were very present in the country and present in the southern communities where Martin had been raised. There was an important moment in Martin's life in one of his seminary classes where he was introduced to the ideas of Reinhold Niebuhr. Niebuhr himself had been a liberal white Christian minister in Detroit and had done a lot of important work in that area. But Niebuhr promoted some new ideas and thoughts about human nature that challenged Martin, rocked his world, really, in many ways, and planted some seeds that would come to fruition in later years. In a way, reading Niebuhr was a loss of naivete for Martin Luther King, requiring him to rethink his own faith. Niebuhr challenged the ideas that a steady advance of reason and goodwill among humans was capable of eradicating social evils. In fact, Niebuhr argued that evil was a permanent aspect of the human character and that we weren't going to evolve out of it. Niebuhr expanded his point to the idea of the capacity for humans to do evil, especially in the context of large social groups, such as political parties, corporations. Niebuhr made the point that the bottom line was really about power and goodness, and saying human nature will evolve would be worthless if we didn't get our hands dirty, if we didn't engage with power conflict, and that oppression would never change if power structures were not confronted. Part of the reason Taylor Branch, the biographer who is my resource for a lot of this, Taylor believes that part of the reason why Martin Luther King was particularly shaken by these ideas was because they disrupted King's vision of what his future was going to be. They disrupted the path that he had planned for himself. He had it all planned out. After finishing at Crozer, he was going to go get a PhD. He was going to serve for a pastor for a few years in a black congregation, and then he was going to get a university appointment, much like Howard Thurman had done before him. He married Coretta Scott. She was part of the plan. She was perfect, well-educated classical pianist, just the right spouse for an aspiring public theologian. He chose Dexter Baptist in Montgomery, Alabama, because it was a prestige church. In fact, it was said that the folks in Dexter Baptist were more comfortable hearing about Plato than they were about Jesus. Now, as a new minister in the town, it was obvious that he would join the NAACP, but he didn't plan on being a civil rights leader. 3 to 5 years at Dexter Baptist, and then on to the college position. And then that moment, standing in front of those people. Usually he had 15 hours to prepare a sermon. He liked being very, very well prepared. All those people, expectant faces looking up for him, looking up for the words, listening for the words that would inspire them. He was completely unprepared for that moment, and he was totally prepared for that moment. Of course, there were many, many, many more moments after that one, and many more crises of faith, fear, doubt, uncertainty. His house was bombed, attempts on his life. Jim read to you about that famous time in the kitchen filled with despair. He felt God's calming presence. It was 12 years and 4 months after he stood in front of that crowd, the first moment of his civil rights career, 12 years and 4 months, when he was assassinated. Now, there were many experienced leaders, civil rights leaders, nonviolence experts who were surrounding him, supporting him, confusing him. You can imagine all the varying, do this, do that, as he tried to make his way through the chaos, find a path in the chaos of that time. But that moment, standing in front of all those people, was such a pivotal moment. We're talking about heroes in our spiritual deepening circles this month. And of course, Martin Luther King was a great hero to our country, where his birthday, his actual birthday is today. The national holiday of his birthday is tomorrow. And people revere his speeches and his brilliance and his leadership. But what inspires me is that moment when he made the choice to give his full gift to the cause that he hadn't even heard about until about 4 hours before that moment. He embraced the leadership that had been thrust upon him as the new guy in town. He didn't turn away. So many times he could have turned away. I think part of what made it possible for him was the humility of recognizing that this movement was beyond his control, that he was part of the energy of this movement going forward. And of course, it wasn't just him. Everyone who boycotted those buses for 6 months, they walked to work, they carpooled, they had all sorts of clever ways to get to work to maintain that boycott. Thousands of people maintained a bus boycott for 6 months. And then, of course, there was Selma. How many people walked on that walk? All were called. In some way, they said, I must do this. I can't turn away from this. They all had to confront their fear and their doubts. They had to find their courage, and they had to hold on to their faith. This idea of being called, it's not a rational moment. In fact, being rational can talk you out of it. This urge, this realization that you have to step up and risk to make a difference, it wells up in you. For me, it shows up in my body, sort of a discomfort and a dis-ease, a tightening in the chest. And then, of course, the doubt comes in. You know, it's not really going to make much of a difference if I don't do this thing. And then the fear. But there might be ramifications for my life if I make this choice. I remember more than 20 years ago, I was called to jury duty, and I found myself in the jury box being questioned to determine whether I was going to stay on the jury. I think my awareness of social justice issues was really low at that point, but it was a resisting arrest charge, and the judge kept saying, does anybody have any reason to believe that they can't be objective? And I felt this welling up in me, this Well, I think that African American men are sometimes provoked intentionally so that they act out and then get arrested. But I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say. And the judge kept saying, does anyone have a reason to think they can't be objective? And I have to tell you, my little 30-year-old self was really scared of this authority. I raised my hand. Yes? I think that sometimes the police provoke African American men and then they're arrested for, and then, you're excused, Ms. Bunch. What was that? How much did I risk? How much did I risk? Zero. And it was so scary for me. I'm feeling this now so much, but the stakes are so much higher. Each day I say, what should I be doing? What could I be doing? What am I willing to do? Religious liberals have been criticized many times for being too passive in the face of hate. Maybe we need to read a little more of Reinhold Niebuhr. We fall back on reason and we talk ourselves out of engagement. Our faith is cautious, and we let our skepticism water down our actions. We spend too much time equivocating and asking, will it really matter what I do? What's the best thing for me to do? Sitting in that kitchen on that day of fear when his courage was gone, Martin Luther King needed something more. He needed less reason, more heart, less rationality, more spirit. He needed a faith in God. He needed a faith in the power of love, a belief that love will triumph over hate and that the concerted power of good can take on the power of hate. When God spoke to him in that moment, God didn't say, it's all going to be worth it. God didn't say, your efforts are going to pay off. He just knew that he had to continue. What about you? How will you be called? How will you conquer your doubt and fear? Could you walk down that street in Selma if you were called to do it? Would you boycott the buses for 6 months or boycott something that is essential to you for 6 months if you were called to do it? We don't know what's in store for our country in the days to come. If your neighbors were attacked for their race or their religion, if Muslims in this country were asked to register, would you stand with them? Would you answer the call? After the election in November, many liberals had a sudden onset of empathy because we started feeling the way that many people of color feel much of the time. Unsafe in our own country, afraid and unsure of who we can trust, fearful of what is to come. I think we can learn from the experiences of people of color. We've opened our church to the Showing Up for Racial Justice group. They're working with the Black Lives Matter organization and other organizations to help white people be allies for some of the efforts that are needed in our country right now. And I think SURGE, Showing Up for Racial Justice, is a brilliant name. I can show up. It's not asking a whole lot, right? Just show up. I can show up. Maybe I can even stand up. Or maybe I can walk or march for racial justice or freedom from oppression. Maybe I can speak up. Maybe I can speak up when someone says something bigoted. maybe I can risk. That's the question, isn't it? That's the question we need to be asking ourselves. What are we willing to risk? We know how Martin Luther King answered that question, his life. But let us remember where he started. This is where I find my inspiration, that moment that he was called to offer his gifts to make a difference. He said he had many doubts. He could have backed out at many times. That moment, facing thousands of people, he put aside his doubts and his fears. He reached deep into his courage and faith to offer his gifts to the world. On this day, on this Martin Luther King birthday day, let his memory inspire us to challenge the hate and the oppression in our country today in whatever small, tiny way we are ready for, whatever small risk you can let in, because it's a muscle. It's a muscle. Every single thing you do builds that muscle and will allow you to engage as we may need to engage. Our mission at UUSS is to deepen our lives and be a force for healing in the world. It's a pretty good mission for right now, wouldn't you say? Remember at a board retreat last year, one of the board members, after we'd finished our beautiful renovation, we were talking about taking our message out into the world, and he said, you know, I kind of feel like we're more like a source for healing. Come on, if you need some healing, come on in. We'll help you. But we're not a force for healing. To be a force, we have to overcome our doubt and our fear. We have to reach through our resistance to find courage and faith that our actions matter, that our sacrifices, whatever they yet may be, will make a difference in this world. The UU minister, Wayne Arneson, wrote these words more than 25 years ago, and they're perfect for this moment, for us Unitarian Universalists. He said, "The way is often hard, and the path is never clear, and the stakes are very high. Take courage, for deep down there is another truth. You are not alone." Blessed be.